I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. We hope in a moment, we're trying to find our guest at the moment, to be speaking with the author of Scapegoats, How Islamophobia Helps Our Enemies and Threatens Our Freedoms. So let me tell you a little about him and about the nature of the book before we do something else with this hour. We are hopeful that we'll be able to get him on the phone here in just a little while. Our guest is Arsalan Iftikhar, and he is a human rights lawyer. He's a former NPR commentator. He is founder of the MuslimGuy.com and senior editor of the Islamic Monthly magazine. He's frequently interviewed about Islam and Muslims on CNN, BBC, NPR, Al Jazeera, English, The New York Times, Rolling Stone, and many other places. And he writes in the book about how his life really changed after 9/11, when his religion was hijacked and the country was, of course, terrorized with great loss of life. He writes about the number of hate incidents that have been directed against Muslims since 9/11 and looks at the culpability of the media, portraying fringe elements within Islam as representative of all Muslims because fear sells their products. He addresses the issue of what will change people's minds about disenfranchised groups. He believes it will be human relationships, as it did in the gay and lesbian LGBT community when people started realizing that their neighbors were members of a group that perhaps they didn't know any members of previously. And the same may be true of Muslims, who are not a huge percentage of the population in the country and are not well represented politically, which also may be a problem. He thinks it was great that the mayor of London was elected who is Muslim, because it will put a Muslim in a very prominent position, as Europe, of course, is dealing with all kinds of issues when is that relate to Muslims as well. So he is with us, which is great. So I don't need to keep talking about this because we can let him talk about it. Arsalan Iftikhar, and his book is Scapegoats, How Islamophobia Helps Our Enemies and Threatens Our Freedoms. Arsalan, thank you very much. I'm glad we found you. Hi, thanks so much for being with us.
I'm glad I found you, too. Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. Well, let's go to that morning, September 11th of 2001, when your religion was hijacked and the country was terrorized and your life changed because all of a sudden you have been all over TV, all over the world, talking about Islam and talking about Muslims, and you've continued to do that these many years later, and will probably continue to do so, right?
I will, Kathleen. You know, it's really interesting. You know, even though there are 7 million American Muslims who have lived in the United States for the vast majority of our lives, you know, most Americans knew nothing about Islam or Muslims until, sadly, the tragedy of 9/11. And so, you know, in the 15 years since the post-9/11 world that we live in, you know, we've sadly seen, you know, the second largest religion in the world being framed primarily in our sociopolitical zeitgeist within the sort of nexus between religion and terrorism. And so it's really important for public intellectuals like myself to try and humanize us. You know, most people don't know, again, Muhammad Ali, the greatest athlete ever, was Muslim. The funniest guy in America, Dave Chappelle, is a Muslim. You know, we have Dr. Oz, who's a Muslim, who are, you know, we're all contributing members of society. And it's humanization aspect, you know, as a civil rights lawyer as well, you know, that's been part and parcel of our civil rights history of America. And you know, this is just the next chapter of the civil rights history and of the United States. And tomorrow it's going to be somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the history before we talk about the present. The waves of people who have come to this country, the migrants who have come who are Catholics, those who were German, those who were Jewish. We have the Japanese who we put in internment camps in World War II. There have been waves and waves of people who have been scapegoats, right? Muslims are the latest scapegoat. Can we put it in that historical framework?
Absolutely, Kathleen, and that's actually the purpose and the reason that we actually named the book Scapegoats is that for many people they know that scapegoats is actually a biblical term, right? And it's basically it's laying the sins of the world or the sins of society onto a marginalized entity. And in this case, it's minority groups. And as you brilliantly pointed out, you know, even just looking at the 20th century, you know, from the Catholic versus Native Germanic Protestants to the internment of 140,000 Japanese Americans during World War II, to Jim Crow and the continuing African American civil rights struggle, to anti-Semitism, Islamophobia and sort of, you know, Muslims being marginalized as our societal scapegoats is just the latest chapter. And again, I always point out again as a human rights lawyer that it's going to be somebody else tomorrow. And it's, that's why it's really essential for all of us as people of conscience to stand up as allies for one another, right? And as a human rights lawyer, you know, that's why I always like to speak out, you know, for marriage equality, for example, or, you know, for universal health care or comprehensive immigration of, reform, even though I might not be LGBT or I have health insurance or I'm not an immigrant. Again, it's important for us to speak out for the disenfranchised because only when we do so as allies can we really, really strengthen the social fabric of our society today.
Mm-hmm. You also, though, write about some religious people who have really taken on Muslims and attacked them, people like Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, sadly, there have been some thought leaders and politicians in the aftermath of 9/11 who have used Islamophobia for political purposes. And, you know, for the most part, I mean, to be completely intellectually honest, this is relegated towards the Republican Party today. You know, obviously we see Donald Trump, the rise of Donald Trump as the presumptive Republican nominee, but we also have to understand that during his campaign, you know, obviously we all know that Donald Trump once famously called for the banning of Muslims from entering the United States, but people also tend to forget that he also has called for special IDs for Muslims here in the United States. You know, and I wonder if these IDs are going to be similar to the yellow stars of David that many Jewish people had to wear during the Nazi Germany era. You know, and it's not limited to Donald Trump. You know, before he became the presumptive nominee, we had 17 other Republican presidential candidates who also used Islamophobia to further their own political agenda. So, for example, Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, Ted Cruz once publicly stated that we should, quote, monitor Muslim neighborhoods. And I can tell you that if you monitor Muslim neighborhoods, the only thing you'll find are the best kebabs and falafels you've ever had. We had, you know, neurosurgeon Ben Carson, who once, you know, somehow brilliantly said that Muslims should not be allowed to run for president, which obviously runs in complete contradiction to the religious test clause of the Constitution. So not only should Ben Carson not be allowed to run for president, he should probably retroactively fail ninth grade civics class. But again, you know, when we see this sort of marginalization or scapegoating, you know, what I tell people is that if you can replace the word Muslims with Jews and sound like a Nazi, you probably shouldn't say these things.
Mm-hmm. You also talk about President Obama being portrayed as some sort of crypto-Muslim. The whole thing of this birther movement was carried on for so long without really widespread denunciation of it. But it also, was it because of that that he had to wait, or are you critical of the president for waiting until his final year in office to visit an American mosque?
That's actually a great question, Kathleen. And as a brown civil rights lawyer from Chicago, I've actually known President Obama since he was a state senator here, and I can assure your listeners that he didn't know our secret Muslim handshake. So again, if you think that he's a Muslim, you have nothing to worry about here. And I kind of joke about that. And it's funny because, you know, when we heard these whisper campaigns of Barack being some sort of crypto-Muslim Manchurian candidate, I felt like Jerry Seinfeld should pop out and say, not that there's anything wrong with that, right? You know, again, being a Muslim in America has become a slur. And it became a slur to the point, Kathleen, where we, again, really did not see any sort of meaningful pushback against this narrative until it took the gravitas of a former Secretary of State, a Republican, Colin Powell, who actually went on Meet the Press on NBC News, again, to denounce his own Republican Party for this Islamophobia. He said, I want to live in an America where a 7-year-old American Muslim child can aspire to be president. But again, you know, that sort of rhetoric carried over all the way until this last year of his presidency, Kathleen. There are some public opinion polls in 2015 and 2016 which showed that 70% of in some parts of America, 70% of Americans still believe that Barack Obama is a Muslim. And I think that is that was a political calculation that the White House made in terms of you know, his visit to a mosque in Baltimore in the last year of his presidency, because, again, had he done it earlier on, I promise you, a lot of these Republican presidential candidates would have pointed and said, see, look, this is exactly what we told you.
Was it a big deal for the mayor of London to be recently elected, for a Muslim man to be elected mayor of London?
Yeah, that was a huge deal. You know, Sadiq Khan being elected mayor of London was not only a big deal for Muslims in the West, but it was a huge deal for multiculturalism in the United Kingdom. I mean, obviously, as we've recently seen with the Brexit vote and the rise of far right wing nationalistic parties, you know, it really gives hope to people of color and minorities in the Western world. You know, here you saw Sadiq Khan, a human rights lawyer who was the son of a bus driver, immigrants from Pakistan, who now at the age of 50 is, you know, the mayor of the largest, you know, city in the United Kingdom. And again, these are the sorts of narratives that we want to help to push out there, because when you look at disenfranchised or marginalized youth, especially those of color, these are the stories of hope and the human spirit that we want to get out there, you know, as opposed to obviously the sort of negative frameworks of ISIS and groups like that, in terms of giving people an audacity of hope as opposed to, you know, a politics of despair.
Is part of the problem in this country, you talk about really a very small number of U.S. public officials who are Muslims, and they've been facing some discrimination as well. Is that part of the problem, that the visibility of people politically, and that's where we get news that finds its way to television and radio, et cetera, that there just aren't very many members of Congress or officials in other parts of the government who are Muslim?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, Kathleen. I think it's not only within the political, I don't think it's just in the political realm. It's funny, you know, in terms of, you know, this sort of Islamophobia that we're seeing in the United States, one of the constant sort of incessant memes that we hear is that, you know, Islamic Sharia law is coming to take over
right. The
United States of America. And I always joke with people, I say, well, oh, really? What gave us away? Is it our two members of Congress? Is it our zero senators? Is it our zero Supreme Court justices? Is it our zero governors? You know, these misconceptions are being perpetuated partially because of the fact that, you know, we're not represented in our political circles in the same proportions as other minority groups. But again, I think it's also just a lack of awareness of the contributions that Muslims are making to everyday society. Again, you know, we have athletes like Shaquille O'Neal who are Muslim. We have musicians like Ice Cube and Mos Def who are Muslim. Sorry, you know, we have comedians like Aziz Ansari who are from Muslim backgrounds. Again, when people see us as normal human beings, you know, the fact that we talk about more things than just religion and terrorism, and we're not one trick ponies, that we're, you know, trying to pay our mortgages, send our kids to school, trying to, you know, live out the American dream just like everyone else. Again, I think, again, as a human rights lawyer, I tell people that once people are humanized to you, it's far, far more difficult to demonize them.
You know, so tell me about the hate that Muslims have experienced since 9/11.
Oh my gosh, how long do we have?
We have a while.
For example, Kathleen, in the days, weeks, and months immediately following the 9/11 attacks, I was the legal director of the largest Muslim civil rights group in America, and we were getting thousands of cases of hate crimes, racial profiling, and discrimination against the American Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities. And those people, I'd like to add, who were mistaken to be Muslim, Arab, or South Asian. So many of your listeners will know that after 9/11, the first hate crimes murder that occurred after September 11th was actually tragically against a man who was neither an Arab nor a Muslim. He was an Indian Sikh man named Balbir Singh Sodhi. He was a 48-year-old gas station attendant in Mesa, Arizona, who, in observance of his Indian Sikh faith, would keep a turban and keep a beard in observance of that faith. Now, again, of course, since we were being bombarded in our media narratives of people like Osama bin Laden wearing his turban and his long beard, obviously he was very cognizant of the backlash that was happening against brown folks in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. So much so, Kathleen, that in the days right after 9/11, he was so cognizant of the hatred and the jingoism that was going on. He was so aware of that, Kathleen, that he would wear a red, white, and blue turban to work every day at the
Really?
Gas. And it still didn't save his life. 4 days after 9/11, a 44-year-old man named Frank Roque walked into his Chevron station in Mesa, Arizona, and shot Mr. Sodhi point blank in the face. And as he was being taken away by police and the TV cameras started to congregate on the gas station, all Frank Roque repeated in almost a trance-like state was, "I am the real American. I'm the true patriot." Mm. Now, on the same day as the Sodhi murder, there were two other hate crimes murders that took place, one in San Antonio, Texas, one in Los Angeles, California. And the one in Los Angeles, California was actually against an Egyptian Coptic Christian, again, who was mistaken to be a Muslim. Again, we've had drive-by shootings at mosques. We have Muslim women who wear the hijab, the headscarf, who are constantly assaulted, in public places. You know, Islamophobia, sadly, has become an accepted form of racism and xenophobia in America today.
And we had the horrible massacre at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, too.
Exactly.
Evidently, the shooter thought that these were Muslims.
Yeah, you know, you had a 40-year-old white supremacist named Wade Michael Page who, you know, one Sunday morning decided to get, go to the local Sikh temple in Oak Creek and slaughter six innocent people of color in cold blood. And again, what was interesting to note there and what I spent the next few weeks on, CNN, Fox News, BBC, Al Jazeera, NPR talking about was how this was never called an act of terrorism. You know, here you had somebody with a race war ideology who committed an act of mass murder, which is the FBI's textbook definition of terrorism. But because it was a white guy walking into a house of worship of brown people, somehow he was just called a shooter. I promise you, Kathleen, that if it was a brown man, if it was a brown Muslim man who walked into a white church in America with a race war ideology and slaughtered six people in cold blood, we would waste absolutely 0 seconds in calling it an act of terrorism. And so that's part of, you know, this entire discussion on scapegoating and Islamophobia is the double standards that we have in terms of the term terrorism and how it applies to only one group of people in America today and how that is actually making us less safe and less free as Americans.
So how do you deal with the media who have portrayed many Muslims as being sympathetic to or part of a movement that hijacked your faith? There's a lot of that that's going on, as you write about in the book. How do you make sure that the faith is seen in much larger terms, and how do you deal with the people who hijacked your faith?
You know, it's with a sense of humor, Kathleen. I am an eternal optimist, and again, I ultimately believe in the prevailing of the human spirit. I believe that our better angels will prevail in terms of our current global crises that we're dealing with. But again, it's all about humanization. It's all about getting out there and giving a different face than what people are used to. So and the reason I do a lot of television, over the years is to give people a different image than the 10-second sound bites that they might see on Fox News. So, for example, one thing that I do rather deliberately, actually, is whenever I go on television, I always try to wear something pink. I wear a pink shirt. I wear a pink tie.
Really?
Something pink. I do. And the reason I do that, Kathleen, is because most people don't expect to see a clean-shaven, relatively telegenic Muslim brown man with a fashion sense, right? So I remember once I did an interview with a network that will remain nameless, Fox News, and it was an interview with Bill O'Reilly, and I remember one of the YouTube comments, and it was really interesting. It was a lady who wrote one line, and she wrote something that was really profound for me. She wrote, "I don't agree with anything that he said, but I really like the pink shirt that the terrorist was wearing."
Oh, right? My gosh.
Now you laugh and say, "Oh, my gosh," and you might sort of focus on the fact that she called me a terrorist, which I've been called a million times in my life. But for me, I actually saw that as an incremental victory because she liked the shirt that I was wearing, Kathleen. And to me, that was that incremental baby step, the incremental humanization that is needed in terms of, shifting the seismic conversation in a more intellectually honest way. And so, again, these are the small things. That's why I've dedicated my life to the public arena and public services, because again, I feel like this is a small contribution that I can make to our collective human conversation.
And Arsalan, the reason that you would appear with Bill O'Reilly was?
Because if I, you know, if I don't appear there, then, you know, he'll find somebody else to beat up on. And I'm a pretty competent human being, and I've been on his show half a dozen times. And we actually have very civilized conversations. And the reason we have it is because he knows that, you know, I won't take any crap from him. And, you know, we can actually bring some light to the discussion and not heat. And I think, sadly, in the age of 24/7 news that we've seen in the last 20 years and the need for broadcast networks of all stripes to fill the airwaves, you know, as you know, Kathleen, there's a very famous adage in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads, right? And
right.
So the more confrontational, the more sensationalistic, the sexier, you know, these things, these interviews or these debates can be, you know, the better it is for ratings. And that's why, you know, even though I've been on every single media outlet in the world, you know, that's why I spent actually close to 10 years as a weekly commentator for National Public Radio in Washington, D.C., because NPR was the one place where we could bring liberals and conservatives alike, and we could talk as human beings. We could disagree without being disagreeable. We could try to bring light to the conversation instead of just heat.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. Arsalan Iftikhar is our guest this hour. His book is Scapegoats, How Islamophobia Helps Our Enemies and Threatens Our Freedoms. He is an international human rights lawyer. He's founder of themuslimguy.com, senior editor of the Islamic Monthly, and has been all over television and radio, particularly in the wake of 9/11, talking about what it means to be a Muslim post 9/11 and what Islam is. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, we like to read your comments there too, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls. Arsalan Iftikhar is our guest. Scapegoats, How Islamophobia Helps Our Enemies and Threatens Our Freedoms. We're talking about all that it is in his book and what he's been doing since 9/11. He's a human rights lawyer, and he writes about how the media is portraying Muslims. He's talking about how there's a difference between the way we use terrorism when it's conducted by somebody who's terrorizing Planned Parenthood and killing people versus somebody who is killing in Paris or in San Bernardino, that they are all acts of terrorism. And that perhaps what we have here is a lack of human friendship, human relationship, so we understand what the Muslim community is here in the United States. Also looking at it's hard to just blame the media alone for the problem that we have actively portraying the fringe elements within Islam as representative of all Muslims, because fear sells products. But politicians in this country benefiting from stoking fear. He writes a lot about Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and others who he believes have really stoked fear and xenophobia and will continue to do so as long as there is such a thing as politics. What do you think? Has that happened a lot right now? What about the stoking of fear, the comments about banning Muslims from the country, the number of hate crimes, which were identified, just a few of them, by our guest? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Let's talk about that fear a little bit more, and that fear that is stoked by people, well, a lot of people, politicians, and it's been very prevalent in this particular election. Why do people go along with that fear? Why is it that so many Americans think that President Obama is Muslim? Why so many would go along with an idea of banning Muslims from the country? Why?
Wow. You know, Kathleen, it's because America has always needed a proverbial boogeyman. You know, if you look at the Cold War, it was sort of the red Soviet threat now. And after 9/11, it's sort of become the green Muslim scare. We've always needed a proverbial boogeyman in the United States, really. I mean, in all honesty, to sort of the military industrial complex and things like that, but also just in terms of, you know, having that sort of dichotomy between the haves and the have-nots. And so, again, you know, whether it was, again, the Gangs of New York phenomenon when Catholic immigrants were coming from Ireland and Italy in the turn of the 20th century, being persecuted by the native Germanic Protestants, who, of course, were immigrants themselves 50, 70, 100 years before that, or Japanese Americans, you know, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. You know, we've always needed a proverbial boogeyman, and I think that that's one of the main reasons, you know, that we're now seeing Muslims being the scapegoats. And again, it's going to be somebody tomorrow. And I think that's why, again, the title of the book, Scapegoats, being a biblical term, as something that is as old as history and time immemorial itself, will continue onwards until the end of time as well.
Okay. Let's go to an email that's come in from Scott. Is it possible to be critical of Islam, a set of ideas, rather than being critical of Muslims, people, without being labeled Islamophobic?
That's a good question, Scott. And I think that it's actually... it should be the other way around. I think it's intellectually... You can be critical of Muslims, but not of religion, right? I always tell people, when you look at Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, you know, or any religion, it's not the religions that are the problem. It's Muslims, Christians, and Jewish people. It's we as human beings that are fallible. And again, you know, as somebody who has not spent the better part of my professional career now, you know, as a public intellectual, not only have I called out the racists here in the United States, but I've also obviously called out the extremists within my own faith, because I want to see, you know, the true teachings of mainstream Islam, mainstream Muslims, make it to the fore. And that's the key here, is that in order to keep this intellectual honesty in place here, you know, it's about understanding our own fallibilities as human beings, that we are the ones that are broken. And once, you know, if we blame it just on religion, I think we're taking out the human responsibility and accountability aspect out of it. So absolutely, I think there is... a great deal of criticism that we can place on the people themselves. And I think that's how we can move the conversation forward in a positive direction.
Let's go to phone calls. Chris in Wausau. Hi, Chris. Hi, Chris. Hello, Chris. No, call us back, Chris. We lost you. Brandon in Prairieville. Hi, Brandon.
Hello. So I just wanted to make a quick comment. I was born and raised in southwest Wisconsin, but 2 years ago I moved to Bahrain, which is off the coast of Saudi Arabia, and I moved there to teach English. And the reason I chose that part of the world to teach in is because I've gotten used to hearing a lot about Islam and a lot about Muslims and in the political rhetoric nowadays, and I wanted to go and see for myself what it's like in that part of the world and what the people are like. And I just wanted to say I've had an overwhelmingly positive experience. And these are people just like you and me, just like, you know, trying to have a life and trying to be happy and support their families. And the rhetoric, especially in the United States and in the West, doesn't match up with the daily reality that you see in so much of the Middle East. So that's all I wanted to contribute.
All right, Brandon, thanks for the call. Arslan.
Thanks so much, Brandon. Yeah, I appreciate that, Brandon. And again, it's understanding that we're all human beings, right? And I always like to tell people that we Muslims are not a monolithic entity. You know, just like no other group of people in the world want to be seen as a monolith, you know, we want you to understand that there are liberal Muslims, they're conservative Muslims, they're black Muslims, they're white Muslims. You know, we're just as diverse and screwed up as everyone else. And that's the important thing here, is that, again, once we can get beyond that rhetoric and understand that, again, we're all part of this global village of 7.2 billion people on the face of the earth. Again, once we're going to understand that, you know, we all have a vested interest in keeping that conversation growing. I mean, our world is constantly, you know, constricting and shrinking. And so things that happen half a world away in places like Bali, London, Paris, Mumbai, Brussels, is going to have a direct impact on us here in the United States. And things that happen here in the United States, whether it's, you know, San Bernardino, Orlando, Dallas, things like that are going to have a direct impact on people all over the world. And it's important for us to stop viewing people as monolithic entities. And again, this is a problem that we have as much in the West as we do in the East. So it's really interesting, Kathleen, because when I go on, you know, CNN here, when I go on Western media outlets, I'm always seen as the Muslim guy. But when I go on Al Jazeera, I'm always seen as the American.
Right. So
I'm screwed either way, right?
Yeah.
It's funny because I come on CNN and the questions become, you know, why don't you Muslims condemn terrorism? When I go on Al Jazeera, it's why don't you Americans close Guantanamo Bay? And things like that. And so it's really interesting for someone like me who has a foot in both worlds to try and speak to those worlds to, again, show that we have far more commonalities than we have differences.
Yeah. Well, let's just talk about killing for a moment, because we're talking on a day when we've got a memorial service going on in Dallas. We have the killing of five police officers, the killing of two black men in the days preceding that, the killing of 49 men and women in Orlando. We've got this constant killing going on, and you have to include what's going on in Paris and what's going on in many countries in the world. How do we take on this? And I guess I have to ask you this, because you've been having your religion hijacked by a group of terrorists, and we should call all of these acts of terror, really. But how do we stop some of the killing? Because all of this kind of killing, what do we do about that? It's horrible.
It is horrible, and the answer is one word: it's guns. You know, again, regardless of if you want to label something terrorism or not terrorism, I mean, if you look at the Orlando nightclub shooting, if you look at the Aurora, Colorado Dark Knight movie massacre, Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut, the one thing they all had in common, Kathleen, was the AR-15 semi-automatic assault rifle. Again, God forbid that a mass murderer should have to reload before they're able to kill 50 or 100 people. If we, you know, we have 300 million guns in circulation today, one for every man, woman, and baby in America. If we stopped producing guns today, we would still have enough guns for every human being in America. And we have more gun murders than every country in the developed world combined. And it's not because Americans are more homicidal in nature. It's because of guns. And I think that, you know, we have to be able to have the political will and strength to call a spade, to, you know, to tell the NRA that they've had their day. And, you know, it's really time to have a real conversation about gun control in America. Because at the end of the day, it is people with guns who are killing people. And we just have to have that. We live in the most militaristic society on earth. And, you know, it's a conversation that we need to have. And I think that it's high time that we have it.
And what about the killing by ISIS? How do we stop that?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to keep in mind that, again, the vast majority, I mean, if you look at the FBI, if you look at the Countering Terrorism Center at West Point Academy, all these think tanks that are going on, that are studying the phenomenon of ISIS, most will tell you that 95% of ISIS's victims or Al-Qaeda's victims are Muslims themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, there is no greater enemy of ISIS than Muslims. And, you know, one of the prevailing myths that we hear over and over again is the fact that Muslims don't condemn terrorism enough, right? This is something that I've heard, and I probably will hear until the day that I die. And I always tell people one thing. If you type in the word, if you go to Google and type in the word Muslim condemn terrorism, you'll get over 1 million hits, right? You'll have 1 million results there of Muslims all over the world condemning terrorism. So I tell people then that if you don't think that Muslims are condemning terrorism after that, you simply don't know how to use a computer, right? And so, again, it's to get out there that, again, it's not only brown people that are doing the killing. There's a lot of killing that's going on, and it's important for us to address the core of the killing, whether it's happening in Iraq and Syria, in the Middle East, or whether it's happening in Dallas, Texas, or in St. Paul, Minnesota, or, you know, in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go. Thanks, Brandon, very much for your call. Let's go to Chris in Wausau. Hi, Chris.
How you doing? I kind of wanted to just touch on the subject of how Muslims and youthful African Americans are often seen kind of alike, and that they are both put into that category of dangerous and easily identified, like a young black man can't change his skin. And you can tell who looks like they're from a particular country, whether they are or not. So I do think that we are being a little bit disingenuous about how easy it is to stigmatize a people, especially when the people who are putting a label on them don't go around them, don't see them, don't interact with them on a constant basis. And I do wonder if we are doing any good if we don't choose to get outside our communities, our own neighborhoods, because I do hear a whole lot how people keep saying, well, how come all the black people aren't helping the black people? But I really thought this was one world and that we're all supposed to be involved, especially when it comes to so many youth, black, white, no matter what race they are, killing each other in Chicago. And I do think that should be a bigger, much bigger story. It's not fancy. It's not going to get you a bunch of press, but it is a much huger story because that is the direct result, I believe, of poverty in America and basically a remnant of slavery.
Arslan.
Yeah, you know, I think an important thing that was brought up was the fact that, you know, a lot of these identities are intersectional, right? It's important to keep in mind that, you know, when you talk about the African-American community and you're talking about the Muslim community, that there's an intersection there, right? One-fourth of the American Muslim population is African-American, so they're black and Muslim at the same time, right? Again, Muhammad Ali was a Muslim. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is Muslim. You know, Ice Cube, Shaquille O'Neal, they're all Muslim, and they're black men and they're black women. And we have white men and white women, and we have Latinos and Latinas who are Muslim. We have, you know, it's funny, Kathleen, because, you know, whenever you hear politicians talk about racial profiling of Muslims, that's actually pretty absurd and hilarious because Muslims look like you, Kathleen. Muslims look like everyone out there. And so that's what we're trying to say is that, you know, you can't just look at somebody, whether if you're looking at a racial, ethnic, or religious group, and, you know, sort of pigeonhole them. And again, that's why, you know, even for example, the Orlando gay nightclub tragedy, which, you know, I went on Tavis Smiley on PBS and called it an act of homophobic mass murder. You know, people viewed that sort of through the lens of religion and sexuality exclusively, even though there are many LGBT Muslims out there. You know, again, the world is not black and white. It's the shades of gray in between that we sort of have to deal with each other in and stop looking at things through these sort of, polar dichotomies.
Thanks, Chris, for your call. Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
I think something both you and your guests, for some reason, have denied to admit, the ultimate hate crime is being done by our government every day, drone bombing. When we go to kill a single person in a country we haven't even declared war on, just think for a moment. In this country, we're right now in a super drug crisis. More people are dying of heroin doses every day in this country, but you don't once hear the president say, I'm going to use drone bombs to go into Mexico and kill El Chapo or some of these other big drug kingpins because they are destroying American cities. I'm going to go blow up a whole village to kill this one man. You don't hear that. But we just accept. Last week, the government, Mr. Obama's administration, let out a report that said X number of civilians have been killed in thousands of drone bombings. But the truth of it was there were thousands more civilians. These are all Muslim men, women, and children. That is the ultimate hate crime, and we're taking cues from our government. And until we get out in the streets and start marching to stop drone bombing, which is totally insane what we are doing, how can you talk about these other hate crimes going on when you don't talk about the biggest hate crime, drone bombing?
Arslan.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, as an international lawyer, drone strikes are against international law, and it's something that I've spoken out against, and I think that it's part of the problem. I mean, and we're actually starting to see, in terms of not only just the drones themselves, but, I mean, assassinations are illegal under international law. They're known as extrajudicial killings, and what troubles me greatly is the fact that we might start seeing that now here stateside, domestically, obviously, as we saw with the tragedy in Dallas, Texas. You know, one of the things that is being sort of lost in that debate was the fact that the alleged gunman was actually apparently killed by a drone robot bomb that they had sent in, right? So essentially here, this person was not afforded their due process and was summarily killed by this drone robot bomb. And are we going to start to see, you know, robot bombs being used to kill our own American citizens here? Again, there are a lot of questions here. I mean, again, the point here, and the point is very well taken. I mean, obviously, as somebody who is an expert on international law, I mean, obviously, drones are a huge problem. Again, there's no one fell swoop solution to any of this stuff. These are all sort of very, very important cogs in a very, very large wheel, and it's important for us to address all of these things, and that's why you have groups like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, you know, that have done extensive research and policy work on drones. We have domestic groups like the ACLU and other Center for Constitutional Rights that do a lot of the domestic stuff, and so that's why it's important for us to all keep these conversations going in a positive forward direction to ensure that we don't repeat the mistakes of our collective historical past.
More phone calls momentarily. The number is 800-486-8655. Arsalan Iftikhar is our guest. His book is Scapegoats, How Islamophobia Helps Our Enemies and Threatens Our Freedoms. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Jim in Madison is next. Hello, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I'm a public school teacher, and during 9/11, my class talked about what had happened, and one of my students raised his hand and said, "Why did the Hasidic Jews bomb the World Trade Center?" And I said, "Well, why do you think they were Jewish?" He said, "Well, they all have beards." And my teaching partners and I talked about that. And the very next day, we decided we were going to teach a unit on world religions, which we could do as long as we gave equal information about each of the religions.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think this is an important part of the conversation to stop stereotyping is public schools have a duty to educate people, children, as early as possible about the different religions. And I'd like to hear what your guests has to say.
And how did it go? How was the course? Effective?
It was great.
Was it?
Very well received. And these were 12-year-olds. And kids learned more about even their own religion, at least the professed one, as well as what Islam's history and where it came from. And they were amazed about the background of the Jewish, Christian, Islamic religions as far as being rooted in Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
So it was wonderful.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Arsalan.
Yeah, thank you, Jim. And it's really, I agree with you. I think it's really important for us to learn about each other. You know, one of the problems that we've had, you know, since 9/11, you know, a lot of school districts around the country have, you know, obviously increased their comparative religion sections of either social studies or world history. And, you know, especially when it comes to Islam or Muslims, you know, a lot of times I can't tell you how many times I've heard of, you know, parents in school districts, you know, becoming enraged that, you know, that their child is even learning about the religion of Islam, or that it's too positive a portrayal and not the negative ones that they see on Fox News. Again, I mean, even those become hot-button controversial issues when they shouldn't be. Again, we should be able, and then they sort of vacuously bring up the separation of church and state, which is ridiculous, since, you know, there's no religion that's being promoted over another. It's how we make everything into a culture war today, sadly. But again, I think it's important to keep the conversation going. I think it's important to learn about people who are different from us. You know, I think that it will only enrich our lives as human beings, and I think it'll only sort of increase our sort of sense of civic responsibility as Americans as well.
Mm. What do we do? This email comes in regards to the to Islam, but you could probably say this of other religions too, because there have been horrendous acts done in the name of Christianity as well. Are there efforts, and do there need to be efforts in faith communities to reform parts of the faith? And would you, I guess, agree that most faiths have parts of them that may lead to extremism?
You know, we always get this question on Reformation and things like that. And as you pointed out, you know, every single religion on the face of the earth, with no exception, has had violence, you know, proclaimed in its name to kill innocent human beings. Obviously, Christianity had over 9 crusades. There was the 30 Years' War. Even the Reformation itself, you know, people talk about Martin Luther's Reformation, but they tend to forget of the, you know, 50 or 100 years of bloodletting that happened after that. And actually, if you actually look at the historical socio-political context, ISIS itself actually considers itself to be that Reformation. And again, it's important for us to highlight the work of, you know, mainstream Islamic religious thought leaders, you know, that have, you know, come up, you know, that have spoken out from Indonesia to Pakistan to Saudi Arabia to Spain to Paris to the United States, you know, against these narratives. And, you know, oftentimes what tends to get lost in a lot of these stories is that, and the FBI has publicly admitted to this as well in congressional hearings as well, is that a great portion of, you know, these thwarted terrorist plots were foiled by the Muslim community themselves. You know, the Boston Marathon bombers were actually kicked out of a Boston mosque by the imam because of some of the rhetoric that they were espousing. There have been, you know, imams or prayer leaders in mosques in California, you know, that have helped put away people also. Again, you know, community policing is a sacrosanct part of any society today. But again, when you don't have that trust between law enforcement and those communities, you know, as we're obviously seen historically between the African-American community and police in the United States, you know, so too do we need to build that trust between the Muslim community and law enforcement as well. But there's a great deal of, you know, there's a great deal of dialogue and discourse that's happening within the Muslim community, both here in the United States, within other Western diasporas, and writ large worldwide amongst the global Muslim community about trying to reclaim the narrative on Islam and Muslims to ensure that the vast majority of people know that the mainstream Muslim community of 1.7 billion people on the face of the earth you know, are just trying to go about their lives just like everyone else.
All right. Thanks for your call, Jim. Virginia in Reedsburg, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to disagree with the guest's assessment that the problem is guns. And I want to make a comment that just as it is wrong to demonize all Muslims because of the actions of a few Muslims, it is also wrong to demonize all gun owners for the actions of just a few gun owners.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you completely. I wasn't demonizing gun owners. I was demonizing guns. You know, I was demonizing the fact that, you know, when you are legally allowed to purchase an AR-15 semi-automatic assault rifle and not have to reload before you're able to kill 100 people, something wrong there. I mean, I promise you that our founding forefathers did not anticipate 300 mass shootings every single year. We had muskets back then. We didn't have semi-automatic assault rifles. So again, you know, again, I agree with you. We need to not demonize people, but again, we have to look at what is killing human beings. And, you know, it's sad that I had to bring this statistic up, but most people don't know that in the year 2016, more Americans have actually been killed by toddlers than by Muslim extremists. Again, so more people have been killed by babies than have been killed by, you know, smarmy-looking, olive-skinned brown folks. So again, the deaths occurred through guns, and I think we have to have that conversation, you know, as an American society today.
Yeah, and a lot of people are killed by baseball bats and knives and cars and all sorts of things. So my point is to blame an object instead of blaming the person, the criminal who is committing the criminal act, is not rational.
No, but it's also not rational to, you know, discount the fact that we don't have, you know, that we don't have mass stabbings. We, you know, these are people being killed en masse by a gun that is a weapon of war. I mean, its sole purpose is to kill another human being. And again, we can have this discussion about, you know, our Second Amendment rights. If you look at the Second Amendment, what most people tend to cherry pick out of it was coined, you know, to promote a well-regulated militia, and we don't have a militia form of armed services anymore. So again,
Arslan,
these are conversations that have to continue.
Thank you so much for being with us, Arslan.
It was my pleasure, Kathleen. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Arslan Iftikhar. The book is Scapegoats, How Islamophobia Helps Our Enemies and Threatens Our Freedom. Thanks to Chris Molina and Scotty Myers for producing this show, to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll talk about voting, the first hour of tomorrow's program, and the second hour, the idea of what young girls and boys should be playing with, their toys, is changing, and we will discuss that tomorrow. Thanks for all of your calls, and thanks for listening. News is coming up momentarily.